The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. I live on a street near the university. Are you getting this, kid? Don't know if I did. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology here on WREK, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovice, and I am joined by the Bee Whisperer here at Georgia Tech, Jennifer Kraft Levy from the School of Biology and the College of Sciences.
That's correct, Sciences.
Okay, who just in the nick of time reserved the right communal science classes for her living learning community. We're just a constant source of embarrassment to you, aren't we? I can see that.
Oh, Pete.
So, but in any case,
don't say that.
We will not be joined by Ed Greco, a.k.a., what is he called again? Fat Daddy Sorghum. Apparently, he's at a conference in San Francisco. The title of today's program is Computing and Video Games. It sounds both impressive.
I am so ready.
Sounds both impressive and kind of wacky. As our guest Lou Lefton makes his way into the inner sanctum here at Georgia Tech. Wait, let me get him a chair.
Nothing but professionalism here at WREK Atlanta.
Why don't we have an intern to get chairs for people? Hang on.
I think that's me.
That's not you. You are the op. You're the operator.
The op. Okay. Well, it's all a fine line.
John, you're the chief engineer. Let's call it chief engineer.
If that
will help you meet people at parties, you can write, you know, super chief engineer, whatever.
Engineer of the hour.
But I guess Lou Lefton did his PhD in mathematics at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in lovely Altgeld Hall. Is that not correct, Lou?
That's absolutely correct.
Is Mike
absolutely.
All right, Lou's confirmed that is in fact correct. So, and we actually overlapped there by a couple of years. When you were in graduate school and I was an undergrad?
I could be.
I think we did. We've discussed this before. And luckily, we never ran into each other because I think the world would have imploded had that happened. And then he was on the math faculty at the University of New Orleans before joining the math faculty here at Georgia Tech. And while at New Orleans, you did improv comedy with Ken Jeong, correct?
That's also correct.
Did that help you in your pursuit of vector and parallel computing?
Oh, so you did the Dragon Con thing.
I think so. If
yeah,
the Dragon Con
yeah,
thing
there,
means
sorry.
What I think it means.
You know, dressed up in a silly costume. Oh, no, the comedy thing.
Yes. I was at Dragon Con.
Oh, you did a great job. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I'll pay you later.
There you go.
This has been brought to you by.
And then you are also co-author of An Introduction to Parallel and Vector Computing.
Look, your name's right on that book.
With Ron Schonkweiler. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes. Professor Schonkweiler was a faculty member here at Georgia Tech for many, many years. And he and worked on a textbook together.
And when you tell someone at a cocktail party that you wrote a book about parallel and vector computing, what happens?
Well, I have a question. Why did you decide to call it An Introduction to Parallel and Vector Scientific Computing? Like, is there...
It manages expectations?
For just a beginner. It's for a beginner.
That's actually right.
Yeah?
Oh, wow. If this is for beginners, I am in trouble.
Have you been wanting to write an advanced book in parallel and vector scientific computing? Who would that be? Aimed toward how many people in the world would that an advanced text on this subject be aimed at?
A few hundred
in the United States.
A couple of thousand.
Five.
6,419.
Oh, he calculated that in his head.
Oh, someone else joined the crew.
The introduction part is that we kind of go a mile wide and an inch deep over a lot of technologies and a lot of different algorithms. So, when you're programming supercomputers, you need to know a lot about computer architecture and memory distribution and the speed of which data moves across your interconnect, whether it be Ethernet or InfiniBand or other fun stuff. Mm-hmm. But you also need to know about the algorithms of linear algebra. You might need to know about some graph theory. You might need to know about some optimization problems, different applications of parallel computing. So there's a lot of different topics that kind of come together. So this is an introduction to all of those things. But then if you want to go deep, Go deep.
Okay. I'm going to pick my favorite.
We'll pitch shift this down.
Are you just randomly going through the book now?
I'm going to pick my favorite chapter title, and I think it might be this one, because I think this one might have something to do with biology.
There are students enrolled in this class this semester.
Yeah, so let me just point out, he's teaching
Gaussian,
a course
Gaussian elimination. Is that have anything to do with, if you had too many bean burritos?
Gaussian elimination. If you have magnetic farts, then yes, that's what Gaussian elimination is. It's you should try Tesla elimination. It's really charged.
That was good. It's much more significant, right? Because there are many Gauss in a Tesla.
How many Gauss in a Tesla, Pete?
I don't know, but there's lots. I just remember Tesla's a weird unit of magnetic field strength unless you have a superconducting magnet.
I found another good chapter. Here's one called Householder Transformations, and I think that this might be one of the things that led to the crash in 2008. Is that right?
That's correct. That's exactly right. We do a full analysis of the economic, the leveraging that happened in the savings and loan.
Right.
You really do it all.
We do it all.
A true Renaissance man.
All right. In addition to teaching a class this very semester on this topic as well, you are also the Assistant Dean for Information Technology in the College of Sciences here at Georgia Tech, correct?
Pete, you're just full of facts from my resume.
Okay. And I looked up your resume. I wanted to get everything right here.
Did you look up his Wikipedia page?
I went to his regular page, though, to make sure I spelled Schonkweiler correctly. And actually, we do mention your lovely book on the Inside the Black Box webpage. And notice I did not call you the Ass Dean. So
as an
assistant dean. So, before we get into vector and parallel computing, and I'm sure that our listening audience is like, yeah, bring it. Let's begin. Oh, well, John's out of the thing. So we're going to have to do our own sound effect.
Okay.
We'll begin with one of our favorite segments, Science in the News. All right. I feel very...
News.
Who was the guy who did the War of the Worlds thing? Orson Welles? I feel very Orson Welles-ist. No. That was just a test. So our Science of the News comes from the online version of Science Magazine yesterday, November. Wait, is today November? No, today's November 2nd, November 1st. An article by Jeffrey Mervis entitled, Are U.S. Schools Teaching Hands-Off Science?
What? Are U.S.
schools teaching hands-off science? It says U.S. high school students who regularly handle rockets or minerals in science class did much worse on a recent national science test than those who never engage in such hands-on activities. Students who never mixed chemicals or peered through microscopes in their classrooms did just as well on tests as those who often participated in those activities. Surprised?
What's the test?
These eye-catching results come from the 2015 National Assessment of Educational Progress, the NEP, in Science, released last week. They seem to fly in the face of conventional wisdom that hands-on learning is the best way to teach science.
That's conventional wisdom was just flying in my face. Sorry. I got it, though.
But I think that happens a lot. I mean, as someone who tries to investigate some of these goofy ideas, we just assume active learning, interactive learning, hands-on learning, these things are better. But you know what we forget about? And they do point this out in the article, that there are lots of confounding variables.
Pete, I don't think we just assume that. I think there's actually an entire body of research that shows that fairly conclusively. So we might want to look at what this test is testing versus what the students are learning.
What's the test? I don't like that test.
And what time of day was this tested at?
Man,
because that seems like the biggest factor in my test that I've taken.
Really?
Yeah.
Morning tests get A's?
Exact opposite.
Okay.
Morning tests, still asleep. Afternoon tests, got some food, starting to do well.
Well, but I might buy it. I might buy the idea that you don't have to, it depends on what you're doing with the rockets and minerals, right?
Right. Right.
You could be just not even doing science with rockets and minerals.
Right. So you're mentioning at least one of the potential confounding variables, which is that if your teaching approach and your pedagogy is flawed, whether or not you do it with active interaction is irrelevant, whether or not you do it with hands-on stuff. One of the other problems is, and we have this all the time, when we try to use the 8 o'clock versus the 9 o'clock as a control, some classes are better than others. And very often, if you're working with minerals, it's a lower level sort of introductory physical science course, right? Compared to the people that are fast track that might have taken that course when they were in middle school, and then they're going to AP chemistry and physics and things like that. So that's another confounding variable. So I don't think this is necessarily conclusive. I don't think they've separated it out. The test was a standardized test given across the United States, right? So
it's the nation's report card.
Right, that's what they call it.
They're just using that as an excuse to not have to pay for labs.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh. Can we explain that one?
Labs are really expensive and time-consuming, and so... Yeah.
Active learning is difficult, and anything that's got interaction with experiments is very... resource intensive.
That's
I agree.
Right.
Yeah, so I don't think this is true. I think confounding variables like the skill level of the students, and then you need to control for the educational approach, experience of the teacher. The teacher is one thing we hardly ever control for, right? So when we do it in college and we only say do 3 or 4 sections of these things, you have different teachers. Sometimes it's as subtle as the teaching style not meshing with what other folks indicate. But that at least was one of the confounding variables. So the take-home message is here, I think the jury is still out. That's how I approach all medical tests, because there's so many confounding variables when you're putting things in the human bloodstream that you can never isolate them all. By the time you've hit about the 3rd or 4th, then you start to see an actual pattern. And for me, what we're trying to do in class with relatable examples is... we give an open-ended example about something in your everyday life that we think the students can relate to. But because it's open-ended, it's more difficult, right? There's unknowns. There's things they have to estimate. They have to guess. And doing that guessing is a good learning experience. But when we give them the contrived one about something they don't know, we supply them with everything. We just realized that's how we were doing it, right? So you need to give them the thing about chemical engineering that they don't understand open-ended. So, you know, one of them required students to estimate what the exit temperature in a hair dryer is. How would you estimate the exit temperature in a hair dryer?
Put a thermometer. Right, yeah. Next
Oh, okay.
To it.
So if we had one, I should have brought one in. If we had one, we could have done that. If you didn't have one, how would you find that number?
I would melt various types of things with different melting points and then use that as a scale. Or hold it for 3.
Oh, you mean without? But that, without.
I would
a,
build
without
a thermometer.
Hair, without a hair dryer or without a thermometer.
Without a hair dryer or a thermometer.
Oh.
Well, power consumption. See, you know that, and it obviously has to put it somewhere.
How about Google exit temperature of a hair dryer? That's what we eventually did, and we found like 3 estimates that were very close, around 65 degrees C, something like that.
Oh, so you're not allowed to have a hair dryer or a thermometer, but you're allowed. The entirety of human knowledge in an easily searchable form.
Well, it's there now.
That's actually like the most accurate way to do something.
That's hot, but 65°C. You could burn yourself with that.
Have you ever held, and that's at the highest setting. Have you ever held a hair dryer indefinitely on your skin?
Now, is this a real hair dryer?
Is this what?
Is this a real hair dryer or one of those little travel jobs that don't really work?
It's a spherical, frictionless hair dryer in a vacuum.
Right. It's a spherical, non-interacting dryer. Well, we can model the temperature, but it only works for an ideal.
And
hair
I'd
dryer.
Also like to really question the entire study of bald people doing hair dryer research, Pete.
As one who is follically challenged, let me say I have little or no practical experience. No, there was a time I used a hair dryer.
Ooh, a little defensive.
What do you think happened to his hair? Fried it off with a hair dryer with the incorrect exit temperature.
Learning the burning temperature of hair.
She cauterized his scalp.
You're in a feisty mood today.
A lot of people don't know that Pete's last name, Ludovis, actually in certain languages translates to burnt hair.
Hate the smell of that, though. Burnt hair? Ooh, no.
I hate the smell of one of us, too.
On a marginally more serious note, we had a couple of callers.
Uh-oh.
We're already very interested about your field of expertise, and the first wanted to know, I think it was Danny from Duluth asked, what does it mean to precondition a matrix?
Ooh, great question, Danny. So... we're going to begin with a discussion of condition numbers.
Yes, so you should explain what the condition of a matrix is.
If I had a soundboard, it would start applauding right away.
This is good stuff. Didn't you learn this in my class?
Yeah, I did. It's good stuff.
It's good stuff. So you precondition a matrix basically to make your algorithm be more accurate or run faster. And what that really means is that you apply some transformation to your problem and turn it into a problem that runs faster, but then that you can undo that transformation at the end and get back the real answer that you wanted.
Does this improve the condition number of the matrix by some scaling technique or something
like
that?
Yes, it can. There's a lot of different ways. And in fact, it's interesting that Danny from Duluth brings that question up, because preconditioning is one of the big areas where I think a great deal of progress is still available to be made.
Wow.
There's a lot of art to preconditioning. There is some science, but there's guessing the right preconditioner, or, you know, really depends on which problem you're solving. And if there was a systematic way to find the right preconditioner, then you could really improve the prediction of, say, where a hurricane's going to hit with more accuracy, more quickly, or things, other things that are supercomputing problems, whether they're related to climate science or healthcare or various other simulations that people do.
So, but when you say, we talked about preconditioning a matrix, and the matrix comes from you writing down lots and lots and lots of linear equations that describe, say, the flow of air in the climate, or the flow of people in, you know, distributing products or something like that, right?
Right. A matrix is a fancy word for just an set of equations. It's an operator, a linear operator, mm-hmm. which is a way of capturing a whole bunch of equations. Mm-hmm. They all happen to be equations of lines, or higher dimensional analogs of lines, hyperplanes. Right. Do we get a scream for that? No, hyperplanes is not scary.
Hyperplane.
Yeah. Very that planes sounds, that are very nervous.
Sounds like something I want to try at a rave.
Yeah.
But actually, Jennifer pointed out at the beginning, I mean, so if you think about it, if it's got a high condition number, right, that means that when you do operations to solve this, like Gaussian elimination, which was that your favorite chapter? you'll eventually run into precision problems, right? Because your computer's only so accurate, right?
That's
so if you can somehow rescale it to reduce that, you get a more accurate solution to this thing.
Yeah, it's kind of like rescaling changing the variables around. The way most scientific computing is, the reason scientific computing is of interest to folks at Georgia Tech and many other places is because a great deal of science is hard to do in an experimental way. We're talking about active learning and doing hands-on experiments, but you can't really do that if you're colliding two black holes together, or if you're trying to study climate and you don't have an experimental model, you want to actually work with the real data, then you do simulations. You start with physical systems like the climate or space or whatever you're studying. You write down from those physical systems a set of mathematical equations that describe those systems. But those equations, like Navier-Stokes and other equations, are very nonlinear. They're very hard to solve, unlike the simple equations that we give you in math classes and undergraduate PDEs. These are not linear heat equations. They're complicated equations. And so then you approximate those complicated Navier-Stokes equations with a discretized, finite sort of linear system. And that's something you can solve. So when you're talking about looking at those weather predictions, or looking at trying to estimate the stock market's futures, or any of the other things that are done with simulations, they're really under the hood solving big matrix equations. And so a lot of computation that's being done, even in machine learning and the Netflix Prize, it boils down to doing linear algebra.
Mm-hmm. Which involves matrices.
Which is matrix equations.
Never goes away.
Did we have another caller? Is that from the preconditioning?
We did, and it was on a very different topic. I can't confirm or deny whether he was sponsored to say this, but he was asking, what makes, I believe, NVIDIA's graphics card architecture obviously
NVIDIA.
Superior by...
NVIDIA.
Yeah. Obviously superior to all the rest. I think those were his words.
So he's asking about the architecture of graphics processing units, or GPUs?
What makes NVIDIA the best?
So before we get into that question specifically, do you want to talk about graphics processing units and parallel computing and what all this means?
So when you're solving these large systems of equations, like I keep going back to climate models, but surely, Jennifer, you can come up with a good biological model that uses large systems of equations.
I don't know. I guess disease.
Protein.
Yeah, disease. Any protein population folding. Balance on a disease state yeah. works that way. It's a bunch of coupled differential equations.
So there are many examples, and but when you go to solve them on the computer, you often end up with the, not just a one equation or two equations. You might end up with tens or hundreds of thousands of equations that describe the system that you're modeling. And to solve it, you have to approximate that solution by doing breaking that big system up into lots of little systems and solving it in parallel. And when you do that parallel computing or vector computing, they're kind of similar. You often nowadays use supercomputers. Everybody's heard of supercomputers. They are typically owned by supervillains who are typically short and have a cat.
There's a reason that there's a humane society right off of the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology.
You're picking up your evil cat sidekick?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
So your supervillain is using their supercomputer to do super evil things.
Like, oh, I don't know, climate models for no reason.
I just...
Off the top of my head.
Off the top of my head, I thought I would simulate the human heart. A lot of non-linear Navier-Stokes flows.
But there are
on.
People simulating the human heart,
absolutely.
The vascular system. They're trying to simulate
dynamics.
Complete cells.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Some folks on this very campus have cell simulations.
Yeah.
So anyway, back to parallel computing and graphics cards. When you break your problem up into lots of little problems, you need lots of little computers to do it. And it turns out that graphics cards, like NVIDIA's GPUs and also AMD and others who have competing products, they're really good at updating lots of pixels at the same time. They do a lot of linear algebra as well. They're optimized in some sense for animations and 3D graphics for gaming. And then we can reuse that same technology for solving the same kinds of linear systems, but for the purposes of modeling big science that's too hard to do in a lab.
But so the matrices in a science problem come from the scientific equation, and in graphics cards, aren't the matrices to translate and rotate big sets of points that connect to triangles that form the skin of your crazy pirate with a Viking hat with horns sticking out of it. That is your avatar from League of Legends.
I was wondering. I didn't know how.
Why?
I have no clue why, how.
Yeah, so 3D graphics are represented by lots of pixels.
Mm-hmm.
And you do have to translate and rotate, but more than that, you sometimes have to blow up that pirate's head, and you have to see where all the blood splatter goes. So,
and those are all vectors of the
and
blood.
And that's all
going in a
graphics
direction.
is a lot of linear algebra.
And all the characters move in different ways, probably too. And
right.
So the
NVIDIA cards have lots of little cores on them. Each of them have their own little dedicated amounts of memory, and they have the architecture of, and in fact, all graphics cards and any multi-core kind of hybrid architecture that uses these things. They have to manage lots of computations at the same time and communicate with each other. And so those particular graphics cards are designed to do that kind of rapid communication and rapid calculation for very specific problems.
So when did we see this coincidence, right? So for many, many years, you and I and a lot of folks, we worked on these weird pipeline machines that were these big clunky supercomputers. And
clunky.
Some of them were cooled with liquid nitrogen and things like that. And then it seemed to me that it was independent, that graphics cards formed all these individual small amount of memory processors that could process all these pixels for these things. And they just got faster and faster and faster because the need was there. And it was crazy caffeine-infused gamers who wanted faster and faster computing, better and better graphics, right? My son's addicted to these things, and he's like, what's wrong with the graphics? Every 2 weeks, he's like, Dad, our internet sucks. We need to upgrade it. I'm like, internet's good enough. You just game too much. And then he watches 3 videos and listens to a podcast while he's gaming. And he wonders why he brings the internet to its knees. But somewhere along the line...
Does the internet have knees?
Apparently,
this
in
is
my
a
house,
breakthrough idea. That means it could get up and walk away at any time.
And then
time.
Fly in your face.
No, that's conventional wisdom.
But somewhere... Guys at these companies said, hey, we've built an architecture for parallel computing. What if we didn't make it so specialized and applied it to general scientific computing? When about did that first happen? Because you're the first person who told me about it.
I was
clueless.
Clueless Pete.
It's true. That's very true.
No, I think it would happen in the early 2000s is when I first started seeing graphics cards. It was really, NVIDIA was a leader in the technology by creating a CUDA as an API or a language where they could actually
applications programming interface to allow you to program the graphics card.
Right. It was a platform that was pretty widely adopted, kind of a good timing because, you know, there have been graphics cards for decades.
Right.
But
they were only used for moving these pixels and points around.
Well, basically. They weren't really accessible to everyday programmers, like scientific programmers who wanted to use them. Just like, you know, you don't really use the CPU directly. You write high-level code that gets compiled into machine language, and then the CPU runs those machine commands. But there wasn't a similar tool chain to write code that could then be used for and compiled or made available to a graphics card machine language.
Okay.
So until that software stack of tools was made available to everyday programmers, that was the idea. And I don't know that NVIDIA necessarily designed it or thought about it as something for scientific computing. I think it just sort of, they decided it would be cool to allow that to happen.
Okay. And that's what a CUDA-compatible board was, right? It was CUDA and the name of theirs? Is CUDA, that short for Barracuda? Like,
it
ooh,
is, Barracuda. Cue the heart soundtrack. Bum, 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 bum. That was a 1970s reference, sorry.
That's by John, who was not born then. Just walked out of the room. Who could blame him?
I can drive millennials away with a single bar.
I have a question. So you said, I think you've, the parallel part I sort of get, right?
Okay.
Based on your wonderful explanation of why that's important. How about vector?
That's a great question, Jennifer. So actually, graphics cards are probably a better description of vector processing than parallelism, mm-hmm. because the way the words are used in current usage, vector processing is when it used to be what Pete was talking about. There was the old Cray computer, Seymour Cray, who is often credited with inventing the first supercomputer, and he designed a vector processor which would do a like an assembly line of instructions. So a vector in mathematics you can kind of think of as a sequence of numbers. Let's say a three-dimensional vector is a XYZ triple mm-hmm. or ordered pair, ordered triple, ordered n-tuple. But if you're going to do an operation on that vector, like say I've got the vector 1, 2, 3, and I want to add it to the vector 4, 5, 6, I would get a new vector, which is, should we leave it for our listeners as an exercise to the reader? No.
5, 7, 9?
That's right.
See, I can do math.
You can do math.
And the trick is...
So that new vector has been, I've done the add operation to the vector 1, 2, 3 plus the vector 4, 5, 6 gave me the vector 5, 7, 9. Well, if I can just do that add operation and instead of vectors of length 3, I had a vector of length 1,000 and I want to add it, I can just simply kind of think of that add operation as going down that vector and just add all the way down 100 mm-hmm. times.
And do it all in one shot.
Well, do it in 100 shots if I just have a single vector processor.
Right.
But that's a lot faster than get the first component of the first vector, get the second first component of the second vector, add them together, put them in the third vector, and all that. That's like a 4 or 5 step process, which is what a single CPU would have to do.
Mm-hmm. And you have to do that for all 100 components.
We have to fetch each one and do the machine add and then store the result in the third one. So there's more processing that's going around as opposed to a vector processor sort of does that assembly line of stamping out add and immediately dumping the result in the right place.
So is it fair to say that vector does the same thing to particular numbers many, many times, whereas parallel does slightly different things with different numbers all at the same time?
Right. So there's this acronym in parallel computing called SIMD, single instruction multiple data, SIMD. So if you have a single instruction that you're applying to multiple pieces of data, like the add instruction that you're applying down your vector, that's a typical vector architecture. And if you design your chips to do that very rapidly, that's a vector processing. parallel processing is it can handle what would be called MIMD, M-I-M-D, multiple instructions, multiple data. So parallel processing might be you take the first row of this matrix and do something to it, and she takes the second row of the matrix and does something to it, and maybe something different, and it's more of a process of breaking the problem up into different tasks and different data might be mixed up.
So when I think of, say, molecular dynamics, which is something we do, where we take, say, it could be a biological molecule, like a giant protein, and you've got solvents around it, and you have millions of atoms. Once you figure out, based on the velocity where each atom is moving, you're just going to add numbers to the X, Y, and Z components of all these things. You can do that all in one shot. But then what you can do is to get the acceleration where it's going, you have to do the interaction of this with very nonlinear things with all the other million atoms. We can put each atom on one processor and have it total up all those million interactions in parallel. And so what we tend to do, we tend to have one vector operation and one parallel. So you might have an inner loop, we always used to do, was in vector. And then the outer loop would also run in parallel. So you can combine the two, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
In fact, modern supercomputers often have lots of computer chips and lots of GPUs working together.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll chips will do some of the workload, and they'll farm out vector processing to some of the GPUs, and there's a
right.
huge effort in coordinating all that data as it moves around.
Right. So how big of a speed up do we get out of all this thing?
Depends on the problem.
Okay.
Some problems that are very well suited to the GPUs have been recorded with factors of two orders of magnitude, 100 times
okay.
improvement. But that's pretty rare. So typically you can get, you know, a factor of even if you get a factor of two or three, if your problem that took 2 weeks only takes 1 week, that's still significant in your computation.
Certainly to a graduate student who's trying to get out there. Actually, so we use a piece of code that was highly optimized by the Department of Energy, and then folks at University of Michigan worked on it. We can usually get about a factor of 100 on some of these molecular dynamic simulations. I mean, it really hauls. And it can really make you do things faster.
Danny from Duluth called back and had another matrix question for you, asking to define quaternary matrices. I believe that was the right word.
Or is he talking about quaternions?
That might have been.
How do you pronounce them? Do you say quaternions?
I say quaternion.
Quaternion, that
you
was probably it.
Quaternions. Let's call the whole thing off.
Where's our snare drum?
Is this the guy who asked about the conditioning?
Yes.
Sweet.
Danny from Duluth.
On point with the questions.
Yeah. So we have math nerds that listen to the show. That's great, man.
Why are you calling Danny a math nerd?
That's a compliment from me.
Okay. Quaternions, defined over the radio, is illegal in Georgia, so I'm not actually going to be able to do that at this current point in time.
I'm trying to remember what they were. I actually used them in 3D transformations. They're a four-dimensional construct in geometry, right?
Right. And in fact, it's sort of like an extension of the complex numbers to go to the quaternions.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is a little hard to define just audibly without a nice diagram or a whiteboard or something.
He's going to need easels and some graph paper.
Fortunately, the web browser, you know, which is in front of everybody in their pocket, is a good resource where after you're done looking up the temperature of a hairdryer, if you can come close to spelling the word quaternion, I'm expecting that that you can get to Wolfram Alpha or Wikipedia to find your answer. It's essentially, you know, the complex numbers, you take the real numbers and you add this extra thing called I. And that has a property which the real numbers don't have, which is that when you square it, you get -1. So when you take the real numbers and then you add this other element called I to it, you get the complex numbers. And you also get, as a result, all possible combinations of real numbers and imaginary numbers. Mm-hmm. And that's what gives you the complex number system.
Right. And so we used it for weird geometric transformations. complex number is very useful because I know when you first learned this in grade school, you know, that the square root of negative one is I.
They teach it so poorly because they say this is an imaginary number. And then you say, well, that means it doesn't exist and it isn't relevant. But really, like, no. It's...
But in electrical engineering, it's very useful for understanding the phase shift in a frequency spectrum, right? That little I thing is a very convenient mathematical way of doing it. Quaternions, we had an extra dimension in our linear transformation. We had to keep track of other properties of these atoms. Extremely useful.
Right. So you have, you know, 1 and I, and you multiply I by I, you get minus 1. So that gets you a two-dimensional complex system of numbers, which is extending the real number system. And it's actually very useful because it's algebraically complete. You can solve every polynomial system in the complex numbers. You can't do that within the real numbers, right? X squared plus 1 equals 0 doesn't have a solution in the real numbers, but it does have a solution in the complex numbers. Quaternions are an extension of the complex numbers, and you have not only an I, you also have a J and a K, and you have to establish a relationship between not only I times I, but I times J, and I times K, and K times J, and K squared, and all these other things. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you get a larger number system that's like basically a four-dimensional number system instead of a two-dimensional one.
It's a shame these mics are attached because you really could have like dropped it after that. Right. Just walked off.
That's it, man. Danny, I hope you're happy. We've just scared away everyone else from the program except you.
I don't know. These are some record high numbers I'm seeing.
All right,
we have a lot of people who love Matrix talk.
I know. Talk Matrix to me.
Remind her. Good afternoon and welcome to Matrix Talk.
Your eigenvalue, minus 4.
So if you do have yet an additional arcane math question that we're happy to answer, or
arcane? They're so judgmental.
No, to me,
Mr. Burnt Hair.
That's a compliment.
No name calling.
If you're listening to us November 2nd, 2016, which is when this program is airing live, and you do have a question, by all means, give us a call at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. So are there certain classes of problems, though, that work with vector and parallel computing? I mean, doesn't it have to be things where you can break it into little pieces that are repeatable, right?
Yeah, there are definitely problems that parallelize well, mm-hmm. and there are problems that don't parallelize well. So, and actually, you know, you've probably heard the term machine learning. It gets thrown around a lot when they talk about big data. Those kinds of problems do parallelize well, often because you have large data sets and you're trying to do some kind of single sort of analysis to the whole thing. Like, say I have a whole bunch of genes and I'm looking for a particular sequence inside that large giant DNA, and it's a search problem, right? So it might be 100 letters long, but I've got a string which is a billion long, mm-hmm. and so how do I find whether or not that length of a billion has that particular 100 letter string in it? You can break that billion up into 100,000 different smaller strings and mm-hmm. have parallelism search for all of those. That's the kind of thing that's not going to use vector processing. Mm-hmm. That would just be a brain, you know, multiple data kind of thing, breaking data parallelism. But that certainly, as opposed to other problems, like if you're trying to do we talked about, say, atmospheric simulation, like say you're trying to predict the ocean temperature and some large fluid dynamics problem, you typically have to calculate every problems which have global information that impacts things. You have to calculate the temperature everywhere and then advance your model one step in time and then calculate the next state of temperature everywhere and then use that to advance your model. Those things are harder to parallelize because they have this sort of sequential property that requires global information in order to advance.
Okay, so localized interactions. So an MD, basically the movement of one atom really depends on only the neighboring atoms, and it eventually damps out. So you can ignore the global system and just look at what's local.
Right, so that would parallelize a little more easily.
Oh, cool.
Did you say things had to be linear?
No.
No.
Okay. But if you're using linear algebra, often you are approximating nonlinear things with linear things. That's right. Kind of a fundamental calculus
idea. So at tiny steps, everything's linear, if you think about it.
I don't know. Physicists might tell you that at the smallest scales, everything's stochastic. Everything's random.
Well, then we'll have nothing but chaos. Dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria. Sorry, that was an 80s reference.
Good, we've moved up a decade. Jennifer, you get to do the 90s reference.
So John's not walking out of the room.
John can do the year two, the Y2K. What do we call that decade, by the way?
The knots.
The knots.
The knots? Do we naughty, really call it the knots?
Naughty knots.
Like odd five, the aughts.
The O's? The knots?
Ooze.
No, we don't call it the ooze. I'm pretty sure that's...
I'm starting the trend. We're calling it the ooze.
Right, excellent.
As an O-O-S, ooze?
Yeah. As an O-O-Z-E, ooze.
So let me ask you a practical question about these things. So if you want to do parallel computing, I mean, is it fair to say that in the old days you needed these big cyber systems or Cray computers or Kendall Square Research computers, very expensive, very big things, some of them cooled with liquid nitrogen. But now... graphics boards are something you can buy at your local computer thing, and if you can find a code or make a code that uses these applications programming interfaces, everyone can have themselves sort of a small supercomputer sitting in their house.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you don't even need a GPU. I mean, most laptops have a quad-core processor, and you're doing multi-threaded or multi-parallel kind of parallel tasks on your computer. Mm-hmm. Back in the old days, you didn't really have those, you know, you had single core or single processors, and you had to put multiple CPUs on a motherboard, which you still do for large servers. And
can you add together lots of other little computers, too?
There are people who have taken even Raspberry Pis, which are very sort of low-powered, inexpensive single-board computers that you can buy for $30 or $40, and connected them up and made little prototypes of supercomputers. But I think to call those things, or even to call a graphics card or a machine with multiple graphics card a supercomputer, doesn't really hit the scale of what real supercomputers, which they still have.
Yeah.
I mean, when you go to Oak Ridge National Labs or Sandia Laboratory or Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, they still have rooms full of racks of machines, and those machines are doing, literally petaflops, which is 10 to the...
That's a quadrillion.
Petaflop actually is not what you think it is.
That's not pedophile. That's different.
If you love petaflops, though, you're a pedophile.
Or if you like animals, are you a member of...
Wait, did I just insult a lot of my colleagues?
You're a petaflop file.
I've been telling that joke for years. And people groan when I say it on stage as well. All right, are you making a bad animal joke?
I was making a bad animal joke because it's spelled the same as the...
That's a quadrillion floating point operations per second. So that's what a flop is.
Floating point operation. That's right. One single add of two real numbers, real numbers.
Can we keep talking about how different devices that are networked together can be turn into the Borg kind of situation? Because I've heard about the insecurity in
the Internet of Things.
Yes, Internet of Things and Wi-Fi light bulbs and I don't know.
Your car.
So are the Russians hacking my light bulbs if I get those? And,
yes.
And are they using it to manipulate the stock market?
Well, the election. Uh-oh, did I just open up another? Look at that board light up.
There are those that claim that.
No, there actually has been a number of news stories recently where... things that they call botnets, which are essentially distributed computing engines often made out of compromised devices. Mm-hmm. They could be computers.
And some of them are voluntarily open, like the SETI project that tries to do little bits of its number crunching, looking for patterns.
Right, but those little Internet of Things devices, your home environment, your Nest at home that controls your household temperature and your car and your webcam, anything that's accessible from the internet does have the capability of being controlled remotely, and perhaps that could be coordinated to pose a threat. Mm-hmm. Certainly there are examples of that. I don't know that anyone has leveraged botnets in significant ways for supercomputing, but Pete's reference to the old search for extraterrestrial intelligence project. There is also distributed.net is a website that hosts a number of distributed computing problems that are like that. They break the problem up. You know, the GIMPs, the Great Internet Mersenne Prime Search is one, where they look for large prime numbers using you download little bits of code and do a little calculation and contribute.
Mm-hmm.
Protein
so
folding
you're
is another.
You're volunteering. Your computer.
You're volunteering, but the what you're referring to with the Russians taking over your webcam is a different kind of computation that's really more about, you know, they get used for denial of service attacks, distributed denials of service. Mm-hmm. This is what happened to, was it last week or the week before?
Where all those websites stopped working.
Yeah,
right?
Lots of websites stopped working because there was an orchestrated attack with lots of devices online.
Oh, so you're basically pinging all sorts of addresses.
Yeah, they're sending lots of packets and lots of requests from, imagine a tidal wave of bees coming at you, Jennifer.
Pretend bees. Yes.
Electronic bees. TCPIP bees.
Mm-hmm. So it was just pretending like all these things were trying to access a website, and it made it seem like it was swamped and flooded, like there was too much.
Yeah, I think it was not the websites themselves that were being attacked, and I think there was a domain name system itself was being attacked on that particular.
Right.
But, I mean, those attacks are made possible because of just the ease of getting that many computers together to send those attacks.
Yeah, that's real. It's when you have it's like the you can't really if you're in the middle of a stampede, you know, of buffalo, then, or bison, I guess is the politically correct term now.
Well, maybe we're not in America.
I don't know. Maybe they actually are buffaloes. But if you're in a stampede and there's you know, hundreds of thousands of animals running, you're not going to be able to do anything about it. Your defenses are not designed to handle that. And that's the kind of thing where a distributed denial of service attack does that, an electronic version of that kind of flood.
Hmm. But I think the problems are a little bit different, because if you wanted to do fast parallel computing that way, it's a little inefficient because you have to coordinate all these independent processors that, you know, gather the data, scatter it, do the operations, put it back in the right memory. That takes some advanced algorithms and programming to do.
But
you don't have to do as much just to keep pinging things.
Right.
Yeah.
And if your problem is like a protein folding problem or a search problem that is really just data parallel, where you can just break your data up into lots of pieces and have everybody do it, you know, a search, then it's...
But it seems to me that one of the big limitations with the GPUs, so we use the GPUs and we get amazing speedups. We're very happy with it compared to the supercomputers we just used a few years ago. It's memory. There's not a lot of memory on these boards. So if you have to store a lot of numbers, that's what these giant computers out at Sandia and these big government labs are a little bit better at doing.
Certainly. And the big government lab computers also have very specific architectures. It's interesting that we're talking about this week, because I believe this is the week of supercomputing 2016, which is one of the big conferences that happens every year. And it's the year that it's supercomputing is when they release the new list of the fastest computers in the world.
Yeah.
So if you go to the website top500.org, the top 500 fastest computers are listed every June and every November, and we are in the month of November. And I believe this week we are going to find out, or next week we'll find out about the...
I'm on the edge of my seat.
I can hardly wait.
Yeah, next week. Lots of exciting...
lots of decisions
results
will be made next week.
But is that... I mean, to me, that seems to be more of an ego thing.
Wow.
And I know China's putting a lot of resources in it, so China's got a lot of computers on the list.
They're the top two.
Lately.
They are the top two right now.
But many, many years ago, it was probably, you know, close to two decades ago, I was out with a bunch of colleagues visiting Sandia. And at the time, Sandia had one of the top 5 or 10 computers. And they always have weird numbers. They're either named after a Greek letter or a color if you're IBM or something like that. You know, Big Blue or Omicron Pi or something like that. And they showed us the computer. And they told us the specs. And they said what it can do. And then some guy took me to a back room, opened up the door, and he goes, "This is the future of parallel computing." And he actually had 100 cubby holes built out of plywood and 2x4s and sort of generic off-the-shelf CPUs. This was even before GPUs, sitting in there. And then he had a fiber optic backbone acting like a backplane to connect all these things together. He says, "This is the future of parallel computing." And I think that's been embodied in these graphic boards and things like that. So you're right. We can't come anywhere close to what these big computers do, but I can put 20 boxes with a couple of GPUs a piece in a closet somewhere and actually get really close to that. So,
well, really close is
close to,
well, close enough for us.
What you can do is you can get you can build a homegrown supercomputer in your closet with, yeah, your plywood and your GPUs, and it will have an amazing level of performance,
yeah,
and it will be comparable to what a supercomputer on the top 500 list was
a few years ago. Yeah, exactly. So the point is, maybe we're 1/10 or 1/20th or even only 5% as fast, but it's my machine. I don't have to submit jobs and wait in the queue and things like that.
What are you going to do with that computer?
Play video games, obviously.
You can,
no, that's
but
the
you
joke
do have
I
to
tell.
You do have to pay the power bill.
We do.
And you do have to fix it if it breaks, and
we
you do have to update it when it needs, right, maintenance. And so there is an overhead to using that, as opposed to, and if you want to scale from 100 to 1,000,
yeah,
to 10,000,
particularly when memory's involved,
you're going to have a trouble, as opposed to, you know, so the high performance computing infrastructure here at Georgia Tech is something that is always in need of improvement, but it's still a pretty good system where we actually have shared resources that people can use,
yeah,
to scale.
And here it's good, but it's no longer worth it for me to go on the NSF network of these big computers, which is how I did that research when I was a graduate. And
that's probably more a function of the problems that you're working on, as opposed to like our colleagues here in the College of Sciences who are doing analysis of the LIGO data to and detected gravitational waves. Those things were done on large supercomputing infrastructures.
Right. So what's the future of parallel and vector computing? Is there an interesting trend that pops to mind?
I mean, Jennifer mentioned about, you know, the Internet of Things and this flood of data, and all these things are connected to the Internet. So certainly the short-term future is all data. It's all data, data, data. Data, 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 data.
Hot new single being played on WRK.
That's right.
Data, there's data, so data, much data, data, data coming from everywhere, right?
Yes, absolutely. And so much that, in fact, analyzing it or even turning it into useful information is challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start to see data scaling, it's a lot of it's experimental data. It's not... Mm-hmm. It's not data that comes out of a simulation, which is sort of the traditional way. Let's set these four parameters and then run our simulation of the universe from the Big Bang for the first 20 billion years and see what it looks like. It's data that's not from a simulation, but from an experiment. It's the fact that I can sequence my entire genome for less than $1,000 and get my 4-terabyte disk and walk out of there with every piece of my DNA on it.
Right.
Yeah. Or you could put a GPS tracker on every shark in the ocean and see where it goes.
So,
but that's a little hardware limited, though, right? I mean, sometimes getting the data is difficult.
Yeah. Certainly the shark example is challenging because there's that one guy who's really hard to catch. I think he was in Finding Nemo, that guy. He was a hammerhead, but he was really nice.
What was it, Bruce?
That was a
2000 reference. Was that a 90s reference?
But the other place that data is coming is information from microscopes and photography and video with a high resolution of digital imaging from medicine and everywhere. That creates a huge amount of data as well.
Yeah.
That's again not generated by simulation, but by actual measurement of things.
Mm-hmm.
So our caller a little while back said that if we had time, he'd love to hear your guys' opinion on the, I'm going to mangle this, Cauchy-Binet formula. And it's our favorite caller, who is also very interested in matrix math.
While Lou's addressing that and doing an integral
formula
in the complex plane, it's interesting to talk about data and genetics, because actually... Jihan Oguz from the National Institutes of Health, who was on the program about a month and a half, 2 months ago, does exactly that. He looks at health outcomes, experimental clinical measurements, and then correlates them with your genetic makeup to do exactly that. He tries to do predictability of cancer and cancer outcomes and things like that. So hopefully that's an example of the future of what you're talking about, analyzing big data.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that the challenge of data is not just its analysis. It's literally, it's the storage and the infrastructure needed. Data is so large, data sets are so large that the cost of moving them around is significant. I mean, if I have a petabyte of data, I can't just copy that over the network, you know. I could shrink wrap a rack full of disks and ship them by truck, and it might be faster. But what's really happening is data, in the old supercomputing world, you would have your data and you would copy your data to the supercomputing center, and you would run your code at the supercomputing center on that data, and then you'd take your output and copy it back and do some graphical analysis or whatever. Nowadays, the data is so hard to move that you have to get your compute to the data, and you have to copy instead of copying your data to where the code is running, you have to move your code around, or even your executables or your little virtual computing robot.
So the images. Analysis of either machine learning or Fourier transform to find one pattern that everyone that uses a particular credit card on Tuesday to buy Froyo is likely to contract shingles. That would be useful.
Good example.
Very specific.
Well, you don't know what sort of patterns come out of these, because the data is so big, you can actually get convergent results, but you just don't know what it is. So that's the future. All data, all the time.
Well, and there's an experimental architecture called EMU, which is actually not a von Neumann architecture at all. It's not a traditional computer, which has a computer that has a processor and memory and data. Mm-hmm. It's a data architecture that moves the computing threads around and moves the threads over the network to do. So think of like spiders crawling over a giant mound of food, and they're each picking, and the food is the data, and the spiders are the computers.
So it sounds like bio-inspired
computing.
Sounds
kind of Halloween,
computing.
Doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So by non-von Neumann, you mean not the standard architecture from John von Neumann, considered the father of modern computing, who, by the way, was a mathematician.
Yay, John
We haven't
von
gotten
Neumann.
To the JonBenet Ramsey equation yet.
Now, the JonBenet Ramsey equation is not connected to the hot toddler case. I'm sorry. It is it's a different case.
All right, and on that note, I think we've reached the end of the program.
You're a pedophilophophile.
The part we like to...
I'm a pedophilophophile. There, I said it.
The part we like to call, what have we learned? I think we've learned some interesting things. One, we have some really cool math geeks listening to us. Who was it, Danny? From
Duluth?
Duluth.
At least one.
So thank you to him and all our callers for the very interesting questions. We've also learned that Jennifer can let loose once in a while. We were afraid. She wasn't here the last couple of weeks, and Ed and I and John, we kind of went off on tangents, got a little crazy with that ignoble issue. This was good. You're letting loose, telling some inappropriate pedophilop jokes. I like that. I think that's good.
I had lunch before the show. Maybe I should always have low blood sugar.
That's it. She has low blood sugar. She's just too serious.
We need to simulate Jennifer's blood sugar with a supercomputer.
Right. So what did we learn? It was sort of a weird stochastic jumping around kind of thing. Let me see if I can apply some matrix factorization and come up with any pattern out of this. First of all, Pete should stay away from any hair dryer examples being being follically challenged. Our Science in the News article about hands-on not necessarily being as good as conventional wisdom might say, despite the fact that it may fly in the face of loop. I think the jury is still out. There are some confounding variables that may explain why doing this practical stuff may not be the best way for certain groups to learn. Preconditioning of matrices, obviously a cool topic for this program. But the whole idea of, in the early 2000s, people taking a very vector-oriented type of computing, that was designed mainly for... Let's face it, teenage and college kids who play a lot of video games, realizing it was the very same vector parallel type of computing that we've been doing for scientific computing for a while. And now opening that up allows people to build something that's a pretty decent supercomputer out of typical components that aren't nitrogen cooled, that aren't part of these million-dollar data centers. Whereas with regard to big data, which tends to be the future of what we're going to be doing, analyzing all sorts of big data to get all sorts of interesting patterns and learn things from that data, it's not so much the computing that's the limitation. It is now the data that's the limitation, right? And Lou's absolutely right. We've had this discussion before. Given the size of these data, it is actually better to shrink wrap a whole bunch of teraflop drives and put it on a air freight, you know, plane or something and get it across the country. So we're limited by data. So interesting new architects about moving the computational capabilities around the country may be the answer to applying that in the future. And emu, what does emu stand for? Is it literally just the flightless bird from New Zealand?
It's a flightless bird from New Zealand, yeah.
Maybe a new and interesting architecture for moving the computational resources around, not so much the data, that will hopefully lead to new and interesting applications of vector and parallel computing. And you teach this course how often here at Georgia Tech?
About every other year.
So if you are a student fascinated by this interesting line of thought.
For those students interested in listening, what is the title of it?
Introduction to Parallel and Vector Scientific Computing.
Same as the book, and there's actually
a
link to that information on insidetheblackbox.org.
And the Cauchy-Binet formula is a generalization of the fact that a determinant of a product is the product of the determinants. So,
oh, man.
That's all it is for non-square matrices.
Do you want to drop the mic now?
Dropped mic.
Too bad it's in the thing. All right. Thank you so much for being on the program. And,
happy to be here, Pete.
Thank you to our callers. And if you have a question or comment about this show or a suggestion for a future show on Inside the Black Box, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt, and we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.